Welcome again to the Cannabis Investing Podcast, where we speak with C-level executives, scientists, and law and sector experts to provide actionable investment insights and the context with which to understand the burgeoning cannabis industry. I'm your host, Rena Sherbel. Hi again, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Great to have you listening with us as always. Hope everybody's doing well despite the volatility probably that's happening in your portfolio. If you are invested in the cannabis space, if you are not yet invested in the cannabis space and interested in investing, this is why people tell you to beware, because there's a lot of volatility in the sector. Today, we have Jay Sharkowski on the show. He is a founding partner at Canna Advisors. He's coming from Boulder, Colorado. He's a founding member of the National Cannabis Industry Association. He is also a member of the ArcView Investment Group, a lifetime member of the ArcView Investment Group, and he generally has a lot of knowledge from the cannabis industry, which he has been in since the wild, wild days of 2009, where the industry looked barely like an industry. And he talks to us about that, the evolution of the industry, why he feels like MSOs should be uplisted, hello, and also why he feels like there's some a lot of upside still for smaller players, not just the MSOs, some under the radar companies, the salience of looking at management when evaluating companies. We talk about the MORE Act. Jay talks about his thoughts on what he sees going forward in the U.S. A lot of great topics that we cover. And be sure to catch us next week, the week of 420, the cannabis holiday, for a lot of exciting episodes and more episodes than normal. So check us out next week as well. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice of any sort. I am Long Trueleaf, Chiron, Isracan Biosciences, the parent company, Air Wellness, and the ETF MSOS. You can subscribe to us on Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. Jay, welcome to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Really happy to have you on the show. Thank you for taking the time and joining us today.
Well, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
So catch listeners up on how you got to the cannabis industry.
Well, it's funny you should ask. When people ask us that question, we like to say that it was through a series of unfortunate circumstances that led us to cannabis. It was after what I like to refer to as the Great Depression, even though it was really a great recession back in 2008. Diane's my wife and my business partner in the industry, we were involved in developing real estate. That took a pretty major hit. We just so happened to have a building downtown Boulder, Colorado. We put it up for lease because we were closing our real estate development office. And we got approached by multiple groups of young people that told us they wanted to not only lease it for us, but they all had cash. One of them was going to pay us 3 months in advance. The other group said they'd pay us 6 months in advance. We asked them, "What are you doing?" They said, "We're going to open a medical marijuana dispensary." "Is that right?" We looked into it and basically took the idea and ran with it. And we opened one of Colorado's first dispensaries back in 2009.
And how did that translate to Canna Advisors?
Well, you know, 2009, 2010, 2011, it was the Wild West out here in Colorado. The regulated, well-run market that we have today did not exist back then. There were no rules. There was no regulation. There was no licensing. We were just doing it. The DEA was very active out here in Colorado back then. In fact, in 2012, I believe, the DEA shut down close to 100 different businesses in Colorado. It was really risky. It was tumultuous. And we had an opportunity. We were approached by a group of folks out in Connecticut, because Connecticut had just passed a medical marijuana bill legislatively in 2012. The state was going to issue 4 licenses for cultivation and processing, and this group asked us, "Can you help us win one of these licenses?" Like, well, let's give it a shot. Paid us a consulting fee, agreed to give us some equity if they won. And about a year, after about a year of hard work, they won one of those 4 licenses in Connecticut. It was Advanced Grow Labs that just sold 2 years ago to GTI for $80 million.
That's a good first win.
So that was our first win. Shortly thereafter, we also won. It was a great first win. We also won 3 of the original licenses in Massachusetts, 3 out of 20. So had a really strong start, and that's what launched us into the company we are today. You know, today we're a full-time staff, 25 people downtown Boulder, and really have the same business model for the most part that we started 8 years ago, just chasing competitive licenses.
Why do you think that they reached out to you in the first place? Did they like your business acumen? Did you have a personal relationship with them? What was it that led them to approach you?
Well, back in 2012, when this group approached us, I mean, there was no such thing as a consulting company, right? And in fact, there were very few people on a national scale, if you think about it, compared to now, you know, very few people that were even in the cannabis industry. So we were introduced by mutual acquaintance, and we were probably the only cannabis people that they knew at the time.
Gotcha. Well, that's a great way to get into the business. It's nice when people have kind of success right out of the door. I think it breeds more success for the most part. I'm curious, like when you get started, as you said, it was the wild, wild west. How have you seen it evolve? And kind of, are there ways that you feel like you're still pushing forward for it to evolve that you're frustrated that it hasn't gotten there yet?
Certainly. I mean, when I think about all of the firsts that have happened, and because it's been, oh my gosh, it's coming up on 12 years ago since we opened this first dispensary. We also had 4 grow operations at the time. But so much has happened. So much has evolved. I mean, just the whole idea of testing and labeling, dosage. In other words, like, you know, you go out and buy an edible now or, you know, a drink or anything, it lists how many milligrams of THC, right? Back then, there was no such thing. My favorite edible at the time was a little chewable. It was called Chiba Chews. And they had the Chiba Chew. I mean, who knew how much cannabis was in there? Nobody had any idea. But then they began to make it stronger, and they just called it a 4X, okay? And then they came out with the 10X, but still there was no labeling, no milligrams. Nobody knew what was in there. It was pretty funny. But it's evolved. I mean, you know, now there's testing requirements. There's licensing. There's regulation. There are security requirements. So the industry has evolved in so many ways. And so many more professional people. I mean, there's public companies right now. The idea of a public cannabis company in 2009, people would think they look at you like you had two heads if you started talking about that. So it's evolved that way. You know, how far does it have to go? It still has a long way to go, right? In the U.S., cannabis is still a Schedule I controlled substance. It's illegal. There's no medical use. It's addictive, according to the government, which we all know is completely false. So there's still a lot of minds that have to be changed here in the U.S., in our government, and I'm sure in a lot of other places as well.
What do you feel like, I mean, in terms of the legalization, yes. Well, here's a question, actually. Do you deal with like CBD companies as well, or only THC-forward companies?
We really only deal with THC. I think it's important in this industry, not just for us, but for any business. You don't want to be too widely focused. You don't want to get distracted by too many shiny objects. And, you know, for better or for worse, we just don't get involved in CBD. I mean, if you think, there's so many of them out there, right? I mean, there's tens of thousands of CBD companies.
I was wondering if you were looking at the FDA and like how they've approached CBD, and it's been a somewhat frustrating process. And I wonder if you think the federal government is looking to that at all as kind of waiting for them to finalize CBD before getting to THC, or you think it's two like totally different brackets?
You know, it does make you wonder, because of course CBD, if it's coming from hemp, you know, the FDA of course is involved now because, you know, hemp is legal, right? At least it's not, they're not arresting people for it anymore. So you could be right. Maybe they are waiting to see how that plays out. But I really don't think they're waiting. I think the MORE Act, which is going through our, you know, the Senate and the House right now in the U.S., the MORE Act basically, it's quasi-legalization. It doesn't come out and say it's legal, but it takes cannabis off the controlled, you know, substances list. It makes some other accommodations. If that passes, it'll make it so much easier for states to pass it. It'll make it so much easier for us to have banking, for capital markets to open up, and for some of these really wonderful U.S.-based cannabis companies like Cresco Labs, Trulieve, Curaleaf, GTI. You know, they're up on the Canadian Stock Exchange right now. I mean, come on, these are big U.S. companies. They're bigger than any Canadian company. Let's get them on the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ.
And what do you say to people that, you know, there's obviously a ton of excitement about the U.S. MSOs. I mean, they're doing crazy, you know, soaring numbers right now. There's a lot of excitement, I think in large part due to Biden being elected and the MORE Act, and also in no small part to the businesses themselves, you know, doing better and getting more serious and becoming more responsible, and the top players kind of reaching closer to the peak of that top. But I would also say that, you know, as we both know, there's so many unknowables still, even if we think it's going in this trajectory. Do you feel like those US MSOs are going to stay at the top? Do you think they're going to, there's clearly going to be some more consolidation, but do you think they're going to get eaten up, or do you think they're going to be strong enough to kind of keep making it to each of the next phases of growth in the sector?
Yeah, they're strong now. You know, a lot of these MSOs, you know, a year ago, they weren't yet in the black. Well, Trulieve was. I think Trulieve was the first big MSO to be profitable. But the rest of them are catching up, and you know, they're achieving profitability. And it's just that, you know, once they break through that milestone where all the investment is finally paying off and the revenue and the profit is catching up, you know, that profit's only going to increase. And they're very powerful companies. They're continuing to raise money, you know, $100 million at a time, some of them. You know, the Canadian companies have big, you know, historically have big market caps, but you know, there's a small market there up in Canada, and the international market has never really picked up to the point that these Canadian MSOs have hoped they have. So yes, I believe the U.S. MSOs are going to dominate the global marketplace.
So, and you don't worry about, you know, a big CPG company coming in, or a big, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, alcohol, tobacco company. I mean, I myself think tobacco, the brand, it doesn't work in cannabis, but others, you know, see those big players coming in. But do you see them taking away any advantage that, I mean, I guess you just said that they don't, but do you see any kind of threat to that path for the US MSOs?
You know, it's really not a threat. It's an opportunity, because if you think about it, a big tobacco company, big alcohol company, what are they going to do? I'm imagining all these like this stuffy boardroom, right, of a tobacco company, and everybody gets around and says, "Oh, we're going to go open some dispensaries and build some grow operations, and you know, grow some cannabis and sell it, make some cookies." It's not going to happen. I mean, the way they're going to, you know, quote unquote, take it over, if that's their goal, is they're going to buy GTI, you know, they're going to buy Curaleaf, and it's going to be a windfall for the shareholders. So, you know, if these big companies want to get in, and of course they're going to have to wait until after the MORE Act passes and there's some, you know, semblance of legalization in the U.S., you know, it's an opportunity, not just for the big MSOs, but it's an opportunity for the even, you know, good single state operators. You know, we have a client that we have a little bit of an ownership stake in Pennsylvania, and it's one of the only verticals in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is about to pass adult use. You know, that's an attractive acquisition target. So that's how I think they're going to come
speaking
in.
Speaking of Pennsylvania, that was another one of my questions that I think people, you know, it seems unlikely, but there's talk, there was some talk from Pennsylvania, I think, and from Rhode Island, banding about the idea of like government run dispensaries. Do you see any, you know, kind of realism there?
I don't know. I mean, not really. I don't know why they would want to run it. But if a state wants to run dispensaries, they still have to buy cannabis somewhere, not just the dried flower, but they have to buy the oil, the vaporizers, and all the cannabis products. I don't see a state launching a vertical operation. That's a lot of work.
Yeah. And they're not the most efficient workers. So you think that they wouldn't want to take it on. I would agree with you.
That would be funny, don't you think? I mean, just think about that. A bunch of state workers, like in a cultivation facility. You know, I'm seeing like powdery mildew, spider mites, and oh my gosh, what a disaster.
Yeah. So speaking of kind of regulations that have gone well, you know, states that have done it right, Colorado is kind of the beacon of light in terms of doing it well. How do you see it breaking down ultimately, like in the states? Do you think it's going to be a state by state? It's just going to be until the whole nation is pretty much legalized, and then it's just going to be a formality? Or you think it's going to be the MORE Act that's going to keep pushing, or kind of a combination?
Yeah, it'll be a combination, but the MORE Act is going to open up a lot of what I'll call practical opportunities. So right now, there are a lot of good companies in Colorado, and I really believe the reason that Colorado, well, we were the first, of course, to pass adult use, but Colorado never had any limits on licenses. It was always an open program. So, you know, anybody that wanted to get into the business in Colorado, as long as they weren't a criminal, they could get into the business. So there was a lot of competition. All of that competition, it just pushed, you know, ingenuity and excellence in developing better products. So, you know, that was the environment that we had here that I think set a really good stage, for the growth of our industry. Now, when the MORE Act passes, sure, it'll give certain states the confidence, okay, let's just get this done. But the MORE Act is also going to allow for a couple of other things. One of them, of course, will be interstate commerce. Now, just because the MORE Act passes and interstate commerce, you know, may then be perceived as legal, it doesn't mean that New York, right, on the state level, is going to allow import from California. It doesn't mean that, you know, Colorado is going to go to export to California or to Florida. So there's still going to be some wrangling at the state level to allow for import and export. But it's going to happen. And I'll use Texas as an example, right? Texas is a state that just doesn't have a program right now. They have this ridiculous CBD oil state program, which hasn't even taken off in the last 3 years because there's plenty of just mom and pop CBD stores that have popped up. But, you know, once the MORE Act passes, and I look at Texas, maybe Texas is okay, we're going to allow for dispensaries, but no cultivation. We're going to allow for import, right? So now you have it at a state level, and it's practical, right? California already grows 8 times as much cannabis as is consumed in state. California is clearly the largest exporter of cannabis. It's all illegal, of course, but it still happens. So I think a state like Texas, maybe a state like Alabama says, okay, we're going to have dispensaries, but let's bring it in from other places. And I think that's going to open up all kinds of opportunities for cultivation operations in California and that type of thing.
And do you think that opens the borders, like, globally, internationally?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it always bothers me that, you know, Canada is exporting cannabis around the world. Now, that world market hasn't really taken off yet. And a lot of these other places, especially in the European Union, like North Macedonia, you know, they're beginning to embrace cultivation. But still, there's going to be a time where people in other countries, let's get some, you know, Humboldt, California cannabis or, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I believe there's going to be global export opportunities for sure. Just like we globally export other products, I'm sure some of our, you know, wines and maybe beers and whiskeys, I don't know. But I can't imagine a scenario where there won't be that opportunity to export globally.
Do you see that, like, within 5 years, 10 years? What do you, I know it's a crystal ball question, but I'm just curious what you think the timeline there is.
No, I think we're close, Rena. I've been saying this. It's funny. I don't talk about banking anymore because people used to always ask me about banking, and I would say, yeah, that should be fixed in the next year. But I've been saying it for 12 years. So about 6 years ago, I just stopped talking about it. But, you know, let's face it, there is a Democratic, you know, controlled administration at this point. We have a Democratic president and a vice president now, you know, for the most part, our Senate is controlled by the Democrats, as is the House. So there's a real opportunity, and U.S. Democratic leadership is saying that they're going to get this done this year in 2021. So again, I don't know what that means. Just because the MORE Act passes, it doesn't mean that automatically all these things come true. But when the MORE Act does pass, it certainly puts us much, much closer. So I think in the next 2 to 3 years, certainly, there's an opportunity not just for interstate commerce, but for global export.
And do you think 280E, is getting rid of 280E, is a part of that? Do you think that's folded into that? And or if not folded in, kind of the next domino to come from that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, 280E, of course, was originally put in place to punish drug dealers. Well, with cannabis becoming legal at a federal level, I think it would be a pretty hard argument to make that these dispensaries are still drug dealers, right? So some way, somehow, I'm sure 280E gets solved.
And where do you see it going in terms of, like, once the states, once the cross-border commerce is opened up, once the global borders are opened up, how kind of, what's your gauge of what the sector continues to look like and how it continues to grow? In other words, you know, hemp as a commodity or cannabis being, you know, used as a commodity, like how far do you think it goes?
Well, when you think about it, gosh, you know, hemp, cannabis, those flowers are the most closely related genetically to the hops flower. And you and I can go out right now and buy a pound of hops for $25. The good stuff, organic. You know, the fact that in some states, cannabis flower is still selling for, like in Massachusetts right now, $4,000 a pound. That's pretty crazy. So the plant material itself absolutely is going to become more and more and more of a commodity. You know, not so much the real high-end flower. There's always going to be connoisseurs that appreciate the flower and like smoking flower. I like smoking cannabis flower. But for the most part, I think flower is going to become a commodity, not just at the interstate commerce level, but globally as well. And then, you know, from that commodity, you know, many, many, many products, of course, will be, you know, manufactured.
And do you see kind of like, so the companies that already have a leg up, if you consider it a leg up in the international markets, you know, certainly the Canadian players, certainly Aphria, the Tilray connection, you know, people think that they're going to be one of the top, you know, global players. You look at other regions like South America. Do you think that those companies that have first mover advantages there kind of get to maintain that moat? Or do you think the more time goes on, that moat gets eroded a little bit?
Yeah, the moat absolutely gets eroded. These you know, early companies, and you know, we can call them large, I guess, even though in a lot of ways they're really not that big, except for their market caps and how much money they raised. There is no guarantee that they maintain that position. In fact, it's pretty clear with a lot of these Canadian companies, some of the larger LPs, that completely overbuilt their infrastructure, right? They spent tens of millions, hundreds of millions to some degree, and they're not getting a return on that investment. A lot of these, you know, larger companies, especially up in Canada, are having some trouble right now financially. I think there is going to be an opportunity for some of the existing MSOs to continue to do well and grow. I firmly believe that there are currently a lot of, you know, mid-sized companies and some pretty good-sized companies in the U.S. that you've never even heard of because they're under the radar. They're not public companies. They just do their thing. They may become public at one point. And I firmly believe that there are going to be some real cannabis success stories in the future that have not yet even formed, right? This industry is still in its infancy. And there is going to be a lot of opportunity for businesses to form, you know, for smart people that are dedicated and hardworking to come in, do it better than those before them and do well.
Which we're kind of seeing right now with, you know, these SPACs that are coming to market, and that's a way of coming to market as opposed to an IPO. It's interesting to see. I'm curious what your thought is there. I mean, you say that there's all these opportunities from smaller people, from smaller companies that we haven't heard of yet. And yet a lot of SPACs or some SPACs, are their goal is to get so big that there's kind of going to be like no great player left to acquire. I'm curious, like what your thought is on this, you know, high number of SPACs that we've seen recently and what you think it does for the industry. And in terms of those players still being around when there's companies that are just growing and growing and focusing on the more mature markets and the best players in those markets, how do you see that working out kind of down further down the line?
I like the idea of SPACs, and the idea to some degree entertains me that, you know, a group of folks, and you know, some of the groups that put these SPACs together, you know, they're seasoned cannabis industry professionals, you know, and that has a lot of merit in that case. There are also SPACs that are forming where people not only probably never even use cannabis, but have zero cannabis industry experience. They're just maybe good, smart business people from prior industries. you know, so SPACs, just like any other cannabis business, I don't think there's a guarantee of success for any of them. With that said, some of the SPACs, if they know what they're doing, they have good leadership, experienced leadership, and they start to go out and pick up some smaller regional players. And again, I'll use Pennsylvania as an example, because Pennsylvania, that market there, they issued enough licenses for a reasonably robust industry to develop. So that infrastructure is there now. There's 150 dispensaries across the state, 25 cultivation and processing facilities. You know, that's some decent infrastructure so that when adult use hits, right, they're ready to go. They could, you know, flip a switch and ramp up production. So, you know, some of the SPACs that are making the right acquisitions in the right states, I absolutely think could do really well.
And do you think one of those states that are, you know, we see California as kind of the main state, and you talked about California a little bit. Do you think that's the market that everybody's looking towards, or do you think that there's kind of even in the smaller markets worthy players to be found?
Yeah, smaller markets for sure. I'll share this with you and with the audience. You know, California is a state that we do a little bit of business in, but we typically, believe it or not, we try to avoid California because California is, it's still chaos. You know, California is a state of 40 million people that has had a cannabis industry for generations. For the most part, you know, it's been the illicit, right? The underground market. You know, to some degree, that's still very, very prevalent in California. Their licensing scheme is the most, by far, the most complicated in the country. There are still cannabis businesses in California that have a legal side and an illicit black market side. It's crazy. We do a little bit of competitive licensing work at the local level. You know, with that said, sure, there's some good businesses out there. I'll mention Harborside, right? Everybody knows Harborside. Everyone knows the name. Been around forever. Steve D'Angelo, they've done it right from the start. You know, they're up to, I think, 3 or 4 or 5 dispensaries now in California. Well-run, professional. I would say that would be a great acquisition target for a larger company. And I'm sure there's a lot of other good acquisition targets out there in California as well, as there are in many other states. You know, Missouri, they issued several hundred licenses. Those businesses are just forming. You know, who wouldn't want a quality dispensary in Kansas City, right? Same with Chicago and Boston, some other states in the Northeast. So I think there's going to be a lot of those acquisition opportunities for the SPACs as well.
And when you're talking to investors these days, what's your kind of advice to them, big picture in the cannabis market? Do you like certain stocks? Do you like certain types of stocks? Do you like ETFs? Do you advise investors in that way at all?
I don't do a lot of formal advising of investors, but just because of the fact that we've been around for a while, I've been an investor member of the ARCView Group now since 2013. So I'm certainly willing to share knowledge and help people. You know, if it's somebody that's new to the industry, even if they're a seasoned investor, the first thing I need to tell them is you have to be careful, right? A lot of people seem to think that, you know, sometimes people think that getting involved in cannabis is instant riches. It's money up to your elbows. And of course, that is not the case. The cannabis industry, just like any other industry, there are going to be those that get involved and that fail. There are going to be those that get involved and they lose everything. Same with investors. You're already seeing it. You know, there have been investors that, you know, have lost millions and millions of dollars. Think about all those folks that were duped to invest in the MedMen initially. I mean, you know, to a large degree, that money is gone, and I don't know how that's ever going to come back. But I tell people to be careful. I tell them to dig deep. And if it's a private placement, if it's not a public company, it's a private company, you know, really, really take a hard, hard look at the founders. So we have a little private equity firm. It's called Trailhead Partners. They're just a handful of folks that are involved. We invest our own money. And the number one thing that we look at is the person, is the team. You know, do we believe in the person? Do we believe in their vision? And do we believe that they're the ones to pull it off? And, you know, so far that has driven us, you know, for the most part to success. There was even one one company that we invested in that we thought they were going under. And because I admired the CEO so much, my initial reaction was, well, if they're going under, I hope they go under soon because I want to pull this guy into another opportunity I'm working on. But again, to his credit, he pulled it off and he engineered a sale, and it wasn't a big exit, but you know, it was three and a half times our money. So we'll take it, right? But yeah, people need to be careful and then, you know, do their due diligence like anything else.
It's funny, like doing this podcast, I've been doing it almost 2 years, and I feel like that's the main thing I've learned, that if you're looking at a company, I would say the most important thing is to look at management. And when I look at my favorite stocks since I've started and what that trajectory, it's always been about the person that started it or the CEO or who's ever at the helm. And yeah, it's just really true. I feel like people are trying to look for magic equations sometimes, and it really comes down to who is running the business, what do they want to do with it, and how trustworthy are they?
Let me share a story that relates back to public companies in that same regard. There was I don't necessarily want to know if I should name it. Well, I guess I can, because there was no inside information. It was General Cannabis. You've heard of General Cannabis. It was one of the early first public companies that never did anything. It was a big fat loser. They had several different business units that just lost money every year. That's what they did. Well, I had heard that there was some new leadership. I heard that there was a new investor that came in with $3 million and took a board seat. They hired a new CEO. There's a new chairman. And I had the opportunity to meet these folks. I had them over to my property in Boulder, and we had a socially distant meeting around the campfire one night. And I was just so impressed by these guys. You know, wasn't exactly sure what they were going to do, but I know they had made an acquisition. They were looking to make more. And they were looking to build a real business finally, you know, knowing that the industry is not instant riches, knowing that they had to do real work and they had to show shareholders real return. And I was so impressed by these guys, I began to buy their stock just because I believed in them. And I'm like, these guys are going to make something happen. I didn't know what, but I knew they were going to make something happen. And that stock is up, you know, probably 3X, 4X at this point. Yeah, I don't follow it that closely, and I'm not even sure what they're up to, but clearly they're doing some good things.
Yeah, there you go.
All about the people.
Absolutely, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So your vision of the industry, like when you're giving, when you're advising companies in terms of getting into the industry, do you advise them to get into certain areas or out of certain areas, or do you think that there's certain areas that are worth getting into right now?
Certainly. So really, Canna Advisors, you know, my main day job, we've always been narrowly focused, and we remain very, very narrowly focused. And our narrow focus is competitive licensing. You know, we do some business plan work, some financial modeling work, but it's mostly competitive licensing. And, you know, strictly dispensary, cultivation, and then processing and manufacturing. And certainly we're going to advise people to, you know, go out, especially when it's competitive, you have to have the expertise, right? So if somebody's a farmer, like we had a farmer in Missouri who was one of our clients. The guy was a farmer. He understood plant science. He had the property. He had everything going for him. This guy won, what did he win? He won three cultivation licenses. Three. What do you need three for? Well, that's how qualified he was. And then, you know, we had a doctor, right? You know, the doctor was more qualified for a dispensary. I think if we advised the doctor to go for a cultivation license, that could have been problematic, right? He wasn't a plant guy. Maybe he didn't have a green thumb. So we do try to steer people toward, you know, the license that best, you know, suits their level of expertise and life experience, and certainly interest and passion.
Gotcha. And what are your views kind of in the near, I would say the next year or two? Do you have an opinion on where kind of the cannabis beverage market is going? Do you see that exploding in any way or getting better?
I don't see it exploding. I could see it continuing to grow. You know, after 12 years, if I look back on the 12 years in the industry, I've never really seen any big explosive growth spurts. in really any sector. It's always been slow and steady, right? Spurts, and maybe it dies off a little bit. 2019 was a really big year because there were a number of states that were issuing licenses. So the industry grew then. You know, 2020, things slowed down. But, you know, we passed, what, 5 ballot initiatives in November, just, you know, 3 months ago. We have a Democratic administration, and a lot of states in the U.S. are talking about some type of legalization. So I think we're going to really come into a strong growth spurt across the industry that's already begun. You know, how that affects the beverage market, I'm not sure.
And do you have... Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so I was actually going to ask you, Rena, what your thoughts are on the growth of the future growth of the beverage market. You could probably enlighten me on that one.
I like to be asked questions. You know, I feel like they're figuring it out. I feel like there wasn't an understanding of how best to bring it to market. I think they're starting to figure that out, it seems. I think to me, it seems what matters the most is the regulatory issues. Because if you're just selling beverages in, you know, a refrigerated thing in a convenience store or in a dispensary, I'm not sure it's going to totally catch on yet. I think it needs to be in some kind of social setting, like a bar, or for it to be as much a part of society as alcoholic beverages are at this point. But at the same point, I do feel like once it gets established in some way, I do see it kind of... I don't know if exploding, but I do see people really liking that. If the taste is figured out, the effect is figured out, and the setting to share it with you know, your social circles, if we can ever get back to sharing things with our social circles, that's where I see it kind of doing well.
I do look forward to that day when we could all get back together socially. You know, I will mention one thing on drinks, because I have a lot of pictures from the old days in the industry, and there is a brand, they're still around. They're called Keef Cola. They started here in Colorado. And I was really happy to find this old, old picture of the original Keef Cola. Of course, there's pot leaves on the bottle, right? And again, there's no labeling. Nobody knew how many milligrams was in the bottle, but there were a series of X's. It was Keef Cola XXX, right? But, you know, they've certainly come a long way. I used to really enjoy having a beverage, but like a Keef Cola, let's say it was 100 milligrams, you know, I can only have like a shot or two, right? So I think one way that beverages will take off eventually, it can't be 100 milligrams per drink, right? It needs to be a two or three. So maybe you have two or three drinks and you get a 10 milligram effect, right? Or something like that. If somebody has a higher tolerance, well, maybe they can get a triple shot.
And do you feel like it had affected you just like an edible would? Was it very similar? I've never had a cannabis beverage.
Yeah, I think the drinks are just like edibles from what I could remember. I haven't had a cannabis drink in years, but you're making me thirsty now, Rena. I may have to go out and get one today.
Yeah, it might give you the boost you need to finish that house, huh? So Jay, this has been a great conversation about kind of the state of the states and where we are now. Anything else you want to leave listeners with?
I would say this: the cannabis industry as it exists today is maybe 5% of what it's going to become. I'll use, the Northeast as an example: New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. Right, those three states have the same population as California. New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, although they have licenses, there are businesses operating, it's tiny compared to what it's going to be one day to have to serve the population there. And that goes for most of the country. There's really only two or three mature markets that I could think of. You know, point being, there is tremendous upside ahead of us, lots of room for growth. Lots of opportunity, not only for investors, but also for business owners that want to build businesses. And you know, let's face it, you know, make a difference not only in their lives and in their families' lives. There's a lot of wealth to yet be created. So I wish everybody the best of luck in their endeavors, because there's a lot of upside still.
Yes. Amen. Well said. I think that's the very, very great summation of where we stand and I think where we're headed. Jay, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a great conversation and hope to talk to you soon down the line.
I hope I meet you in person one day, Rena, when we could travel again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're still in Boulder, Boulder's one of my favorite places to go. So definitely either there or here, I would love it. Thanks so much for listening to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Subscribe or follow us on Seeking Alpha, Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or Stitcher. And we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other investors find our show. If you have feedback or questions, we'd love to hear from you at Rena+CANPOD@SeekingAlpha.com. That's RENA+CANPOD@SeekingAlpha.com. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.